Experience is the best teacher. You've probably known that familiar maxim to the test and found it's pretty reliable. Experience certainly removes the foolishness and naivete of theory, but is that maxim absolutely true? I don't think so. We certainly learn by doing. No question about that. But I think you'd agree that another word is needed to make that an accurate maxim. Guided experience is the best teacher. If you play a musical instrument, you likely began at an early age, guided by an experienced teacher. Chuck Swindoll explains, when I was a teenager, my oboe instructor was Mr. Villani, who was a member of the Houston Symphony Orchestra. At the beginning each week, as he taught the lesson, which was done in my home, this fine musician would slowly put his oboe together, and I'd have mine ready, and then we'd begin to play a few notes. But only a few notes into the piece, and he'd exclaim, "No, no, 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 no," which in Italian means, "No, no, 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 no." He'd correct my fingering. He'd correct my aperture. He'd inform me of a better way to tongue my notes. And then we'd continue a few more bars, and he would stop me again. Week by week, throughout the year, 45 minutes at a crack, Mr. Villani guided me into a more acceptable oboe technique. The brilliant surgeon has her fellows under her expert guidance with unflappable pilot, takes a young co-pilot in the precise sequence of preparation for takeoff and or landing. A renowned soloist schools her pupil in the fine art of flawless vocal performance. Guided experience is the best teacher because it adds a crucial, often uncomfortable element to the process, confrontation. Confrontation guides the oboe instructor who shows his young student how to form his lips properly across the double reed. The seasoned surgeon who drills her young fellows in the protocol of making a clean incision, or the respected professional who demands repeated attempts at a difficult section of the musical score until the young singer approaches near perfection. Sadly, confrontation is usually avoided because it carries such a negative appeal. No one enjoys confrontation. I think I figured out why it's true. It's because we are offended by people in our lives who know better how to affront than to confront. There's a world of difference. Confrontation is never fun. Getting through the tough stuff of confrontation correctly requires that we gain a solid understanding of God's perspective on that process. And so once again, let's turn to the scriptures in pursuit of that perspective. Interestingly, the word confrontation doesn't appear in our Bible, yet the concept runs through it like a thread through the biblical story. In fact, there are at least five synonyms throughout the Old and the New Testament that shed light on the idea. So to help us begin on the same page, let's look at the first four, which are out of the book of Proverbs. The first one, reprove. He is on the path of life who heeds instruction, but he who ignores reproof goes astray. Proverbs 10:17. Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates reproof is stupid. That's pretty direct. Proverbs 12:1. No one enjoys a strong reproof, but from time to time we really need it, especially when it comes from God or from someone who is not only qualified, but also loves us and has our best interest in view. Great good can come from it. In fact, Proverbs 13:18 teaches poverty and shame will come to him who neglects discipline, but he who regards reproof will be honored. The second synonym is rebuke, which is a bit sterner than reproof, but carries on the idea of guided confrontation. Proverbs 17:10, a rebuke goes deeper into one who has understanding than 100 blows into a fool. Pound on the body of a fool day after day, month after month, and you have little or no impact. But for the one who has an understanding, teachable spirit, a tactfully stated rebuke is sufficient. The third synonym is wound. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Proverbs 27:6. Confrontation can be a wounding experience. It hurts deep down inside. It stings. But when the confronter is a friend who truly knows me, loves me, the benefits are real and lasting. And by the way, not everyone has a right to wound us. Only a close, trustworthy friend, someone like a mentor. Yet some people, especially fellow Christians, see themselves as having the gift of confrontation. Legalism are especially given to that kind of thinking, and they are regularly an affront to others. They use a Bible verse to support their caustic or damaging behavior. You and I are much more open to being confronted by someone that we trust, someone who loves us, someone who cares about us. And that's why the very best confrontation comes early on between a parent and a child. How essential is a guided confrontation during those growing up years? How unwise are those parents who fail to confront? The loving, grace-filled instruction brought on by the wound of a faithful parent are trustworthy, long-lasting. A fourth synonym is correct. Correct your son and he will give you comfort. He will also delight your soul. Proverbs 29:17. Correct also includes the thought of confrontation designed to impress one's character and improve it. It's the idea of rescuing someone from the wrong path and placing him or her on the correct one. And finally, the word discipline is often a synonym for confrontation. And this, for a closer look at that word, we need to turn from Proverbs into the book of Hebrews, chapter 12, verses 7 and 8. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom the father does not discipline? But if you're without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and hurt not sons. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Reprove, rebuke, wound, correct, discipline. Terms full of meaning. And contrary to public opinion, confrontation is an art to be learned and refined. David Augsburger, in the book that has helped so many, Caring Enough to Confront, refers to the process of confrontation as care fronting. So what does confrontation mean? Taken all together, all these biblical words help bring focus on what true confrontation should be. Here's how Chuck Swindoll defines confrontation in a nutshell. Confrontation is speaking the truth in a personal, face-to-face encounter with someone you love regarding an issue that needs attention or correction. Confrontation is speaking the truth in a personal, face-to-face encounter with someone we love regarding an issue that needs attention or correction. But let me repeat, the goal of confrontation is neither to attack nor to cause offense. That's a controlling spiritual king of the mountain kind of attitude, which never works. No, confrontation is designed to define the issue of concern with the hope of bringing about a needed change with tactfulness and love. So getting and going through the tough stuff of confrontation requires some deliberate thinking. Here are four guiding principles that distill what the scriptures affirm. First, state the issue tactfully and directly. Confrontation is rarely done indirectly, seldom done publicly. There must be clear, thoughtful communication delivered firmly but graciously. And secondly, provide examples without exaggeration or a lot of emotion. Examples are stated to prove the point. Something has been going on that cannot continue for certain reasons that must be stated. So point out these things that demonstrate that change has not occurred and provide specific examples. Careful to keep your emotions in check, allowing enough time between the offense and the confrontation for prayerful diffusing of anger and bitterness and frustration that you may feel. And third, make a plan of action. Don't leave the individual you've confronted to stew and brew without clear direction on how to improve. That's not constructive, and it can lead to more intense issues and unwanted complication. The best approach is simply to identify the problem and calmly suggest ways the problem can be corrected. And finally, show compassion, understanding. Don't miss that part. If you do, you'll find yourself accusing rather than confronting. So compassion, care, concern, and love are all essential ingredients in a successful confrontation. These virtues are more easily understood when we see them in action. So once again, let's turn to the Master, who all his life regularly had to endure the tough stuff of confrontation. For him, too, it was always something. Only in this case that we'll look at today, it was Peter who routinely needed Christ's firm confronting, which included a series of interventions that eventually formed in him a rugged and a resilient faith. As Jesus stepped into the shadow of the cross, his episodes of confrontation increased, intensified. Three passages portray his encounters with Peter, as you know, a man he deeply loved, who repeatedly expressed devotion to his master. In each scene, we watch Jesus skillfully and lovingly carve away at Peter's character, taking him from being a rough-edged and raw disciple to a perfectly cut stone, the rock to become the foundation of the church. In the first scene, the shadow of the cross looms over Jesus as well as his disciples. Turn to Matthew 16. We'll look at verses 21 to 23. From then on, Jesus began to tell his disciples plainly what it was necessary for him to go to Jerusalem and that he would suffer many terrible things at the hands of the elders, the leading priests, and the teachers of religious law. He would be killed, but on the third day, he would be raised from the dead. As you know, the disciples were waiting for Jesus to establish his earthly kingdom, a literal kingdom that would deliver them from the power and the oppression of the Gentile rule. And Christ, the anointed one, would conquer. Therefore, the idea of a suffering Messiah never really crossed their minds. William Barclay says, rather than embracing such a concept, they wanted to protect him from it. Peter, frequently quick to speak his mind, quote, flung a protective arm around Jesus as if to hold him back from that suicidal course. Matthew writes in verse 22, but Peter took him aside and began to reprimand Jesus for saying such things. Heaven forbid, Lord. This will never happen to you. But Jesus wasted no time or words in confronting Peter and his flawed understanding. Verse 23, Jesus turned to Peter and said, get away from me, Satan. You are a dangerous trap to me. You are seeing things merely from a human point of view, not from God's. Talk about a strong rebuke. It must have stung. Peter says nothing in return. Imagine being convinced of your own ardor for Christ and suddenly realizing that the devil has put a thought into your head and you're a mouthpiece for the adversary. We need to be aware that the evil one can put thoughts in our head and recognize that your thoughts run your life. 2 Corinthians 10:5 gives us action to take. We demolish arguments and every pretension that can set itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. Capturing thoughts is serious business. It was to Christ. Max Lucado reinforces this concept. Remember the thoughts that came his way, courtesy of the mouth of Peter? Jesus had just prophesied his death, burial, resurrection, but Peter couldn't bear the thought of it. Peter took him aside and began to correct him. And Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Do you see the decisiveness of Jesus? A trashy thought comes his way. He is tempted to entertain it. A crossless life would be nice. But what does he do? He stands and says, get away from me. As if to say, you're not allowed to enter my mind. What if you did that? What if you took every thought captive? What if you refused to let any trash enter your mind? What if you took the counsel of Solomon in Proverbs 4:23? Be careful what you think, because your thoughts run your life. Like Peter, we don't even know we're mistaken until someone cares enough to confront us. The second scene is of even greater magnitude than the first because it is closer to the cross. Jesus' death is imminent, and the enemy's working has intensified. And in the privacy of his upper room, Jesus has just finished a dramatic lesson on what it means to be a servant as he washed the disciples' feet. And what he said next, though, must have sent shockwaves through the room as he again directed his words to Peter. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded to to permission to sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And you, when once you have turned again, strengthen your brother. Don't rush past that too quickly. Can you imagine being singled out in front of your peers and being told that Satan has a plan for you, just for you? Literally, Jesus said, Satan has begged earnestly for you. In other words, he wants you for himself. He wants you. What's he saying? Peter, you're in the devil's crosshairs. Chuck Swindoll probes, you think that still goes on? Do you think Satan's demons are plotting to destroy or at least spiritually disable significant people in God's family? Without question. Don't doubt that for a minute. But thankfully, the Savior still prays for us. John 17:15, 1 John 2:1. He consistently prays for our preservation, for our strength. Not surprisingly, Jesus confronted Peter's pious braggadocio. I say to you, Peter, the rooster will not crow today until you have denied me three times that you know me. Only by God's grace, by the overcoming power, can any of us stand protected against Satan's schemes. This scene helps us understand why we confront. Two reasons. First, we confront to strengthen areas of vulnerability. Second, we confront to soften overconfidence, to warn of blind spots. Confronting those we love helps protect them from Satan's sinister assaults, from their own self-destructive overconfidence. And the final scene in Luke 22, verses 47 to 51, occurs the night before Christ's agonizing death. And to be more precise, it's the early morning hours of that fateful day. The disciples have seen their final meal, have eaten it with Jesus. Christ has endured a grueling night in the Garden of Gethsemane. Soon the mob emerges from the darkness with torches flickering in the shadows of the olive trees, and Jesus, the traitor with murder in his heart, leads the posse. The disciples standing with Jesus grow indignant in his defense. Who, when those who were around him saw what was going to happen, they said, "The Lord, shall we not strike with a sword?" And one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear. Would you care to guess the identity of the sword-swinging aggressor who slashed the slave in Christ's defense? Luke doesn't give us his name, but John does. And of course, you guessed right. Peter, the impetuous one, he strikes again. Jesus immediately took control of the situation, and in doing so, he confronted the overly aggressive disciple. But Jesus answered and said, "Stop, no more of this." And he touched his ear and healed him. The next time you need to confront, Chuck Swindoll suggests that we follow the example of Christ, who lovingly yet firmly met each confrontation with fitting resolve, never shirking from the truth. He always sought to meet the needs of those closest to him. And from his example, we find three essentials of what we could call people-affirming, God-honoring confrontation. And that's first, to be sure. Be sure there's a good reason to confront another individual. Confrontations should be rare events. You shouldn't relish the experience, and if you do, be concerned enough to stop right then and enhance and examine your motives. Second, Be specific. Be specific about the purpose of the confrontation. Don't leave this to speculation. Being vague leads us to an uncertain outcome, no matter how tactful or gracious your words may be. Make certain you know the reason for the confrontation, and make sure that reason is clear to the person you confront. Spell it out precisely, concisely. And third, be sensitive. Every situation is different. An extended season of soul-searching prayer must precede any face-to-face confrontation. Without that discipline of reflection, you're setting yourselves up for an enemy assault. Furthermore, the person you're confronting will sense uncertainty and uneasiness in your words, so don't run that risk. If you haven't the time to pray and seek godly counsel on the matter, then don't proceed. Don't push yourself in on your own. Every time that type of Clint Eastwood, "Make My Day" approach happens, what's left behind is a bloody trail of wounded souls. So in closing, this is also a good time to add, make certain the method you choose fits the needs of the other person, keeping your own personal agenda in check. None of this is about you. Pay attention to timing. Choose your words carefully, and for sure pray fervently. Cutting through the tough stuff of confrontation is not easy or simple, especially when it means challenging a person that you really love. But if we love someone as dearly, as deeply as Christ loved Peter, we won't hold back. We will care enough to confront. Selah.